confrontation between scriptural data and modern knowledge. The narrations contained in the Bible and the Quran on the time spent by the sons of Israel in Egypt, and the way they left, give rise to data which may constitute matter for a confrontation with modern knowledge. In fact, the balance is very uneven because some data pose many problems while others hardly provide subject for discussion. 1. Examination of certain details contained in the narrations the Hebrews in Egypt. It is, apparently, quite possible to say, and without running much risk of being wrong, that the Hebrews remained in Egypt for 400 or 430 years, according to the Bible, Genesis 15, 13 and Exodus 12, 40. In spite of this discrepancy between Genesis and Exodus, which is of minor importance, the period may be said to have begun long after Abraham, when Joseph, son of Jacob, moved with his brothers to Egypt. With the exception of the Bible, which gives the data just quoted, and the Quran which refers to the move to Egypt, but does not give any indication as to the dates involved, we do not possess any other document which is able to illuminate us on this point. Present-day commentators, ranging from P. Montet to Daniel Rops, think that, in all probability, the arrival of Joseph and his brothers coincided with the movement of the Hyksos towards Egypt in the 17th century before Christ, and that a Hyksos sovereign probably received them hospitably at Avaris in the Nile Delta. There can be no doubt that this guess is in obvious contradiction to what is contained in the Bible, Kings 6:1, which puts the exodus from Egypt at 480 years before the construction of Solomon's Temple, circa 971 before Christ. This estimation would therefore put the Exodus at roughly 1450 before Christ and would consequently situate the entry into Egypt at circa 1880-1850 before Christ. This is precisely the time, however, that Abraham is supposed to have lived, and other data contained in the Bible tell us that there were 250 years separating him from Joseph. This passage from Kings in the Bible is therefore unacceptable from a chronological point of view. We shall see how the theory put forward here has only this objection, taken from Kings, to be leveled against it. The very obvious inaccuracy of these chronological data effectively deprives this objection of any value. Aside from the Holy Scriptures, the traces left by the Hebrews of their stay in Egypt are very faint. There are, however, several hieroglyphic documents which refer to the existence in Egypt of a category of workers called the Aperu, Haperu or Habiru, who have been identified, rightly or wrongly, with the Hebrews. In this category were construction workers, agricultural laborers, harvesters, etc. But where did they come from? It is very difficult to find an answer to this. Father de Vaux has written the following about them: they are not members of the local population, they do not identify themselves with a class in society, they do not all share the same occupation or status. Under Thutmosis III, they are referred to in a papyrus as workers in the stables. It is known how Amenophis II, in the 15th century before Christ, brought in 3,600 of these people as prisoners from Canaan, because, as Father de Vaux notes, they constituted a considerable percentage of the Syrio-Palestinian population. Under Sethus I, in circa 1300 before Christ, the Aperu created considerable disturbances in the Beth Shean region of Canaan, and under Rameses II some of them were employed in the quarries or for transporting piles used in the works of the pharaoh, for example the great pylon of Rameses Miamon. We know from the Bible that the Hebrews, under Rameses II, were to build the northern capital, the city of Rameses. In Egyptian writings the Aperu are mentioned once again in the 12th century before Christ and for the last time under Rameses III. The Aperu are not just mentioned in Egypt, however, so did the term therefore apply solely to the Hebrews. It is perhaps wise to recall that the word could initially have been used to signify forced laborers, without regard to their origins, and that it subsequently became an adjective indicating a person's profession. We might perhaps draw an analogy with the word Suisse, Swiss, which has several different meanings in French. It can mean an inhabitant of Switzerland, a mercenary soldier of the old French monarchy, who was of Swiss extraction, a Vatican guard, or an employee of a Christian church. However, this may be, under Ramesses II, the Hebrews, according to the Bible, or the Apuru, according to the hieroglyphic texts, took part in the great works ordered by the Pharaoh, which were indeed forced labor. There can be no doubt that Ramesses II was the Jews' oppressor. The cities of Ramesses and Pitom, mentioned in Exodus, are situated at the eastern part of the Nile Delta. Today's Tanis and Kantra, which are roughly 15 miles apart, are in the same region as these two cities. The northern capital constructed by Ramesses II was situated there. Ramesses II is the Pharaoh of the oppression. Moses was to be born in this environment. The circumstances pertaining to his rescue from the waters of the river have already been outlined above. He has an Egyptian name. P. Montet has clearly shown in his book Egypt and the Bible that the names Messi are on the list of personal names in the Dictionary of the Hieroglyphic Language by Ranker. Musa is the transliteration used in the Quran. The Plagues of Egypt. Under this title, the Bible refers to 10 punishments inflicted by God, and provides many details concerning each of these plagues. Many have supernatural dimensions or characteristics. The Quran only lists 5 plagues, which, for the most part, are merely an exaggeration of natural phenomena: flooding, locusts, lice, frogs, and blood. The rapid multiplication of locusts and frogs is described in the Bible. It speaks of river water changed to blood, which floods all the land. Sick, the Quran refers to blood, but without giving any complementary details. It is possible to invent all kinds of hypotheses on the subject of this reference to blood. The other plagues described in the Bible, gnats, swarms of flies, boils, hail, darkness, death of the firstborn and of cattle, have various origins, as was the case of the flood, and are constituted by the juxtaposition of passages from many different sources. The route taken by the Exodus. No indication of this is given in the Quran, whereas the Bible refers to it in great detail. Father de Vaux and P. Montet have both reopened studies into it. The starting point was probably the Tanis-Kantra region, but no traces have been found of the rest of the route taken which could confirm the biblical narration, nor is it possible to say at exactly what point the waters parted to allow the passage of Moses and his followers. The miraculous parting of the waters. Some commentators have imagined a tide race, due perhaps to astronomic causes or seismic conditions connected to the distant eruption of a volcano. The Hebrews could have taken advantage of the receding sea, and the Egyptians, following in hot pursuit, could have been wiped out by the returning tide. All this is pure hypothesis, however. 2. The point occupied by the Exodus in the history of the pharaohs. It is possible to arrive at much more positive evidence in the case of the point the Exodus occupies in time. For a very long time, Meneptah, the successor to Ramesses II, was held to be the pharaoh of the Exodus. Maspero, the famous Egyptologist of the beginning of this century, did, after all, write in his Visitor's Guide to the Cairo Museum, 1900, that Meneptah was probably, according to the Alexandrian tradition, the pharaoh of the Exodus who is said to have perished in the Red Sea. I have been unable to find the documents on which Maspero based this assertion, but the eminence of this commentator requires us to attach the greatest importance to what he claims. Apart from P. Montet, there are very few Egyptologists or specialists in biblical exegesis who have researched into the arguments for or against this hypothesis. In the last few decades, however, there has been a spate of different hypotheses which seem to have as their sole purpose the justification of an agreement with one single detail in the scriptural narrations, although the inventors of these hypotheses do not bother with the other aspects of the scriptures. Thus it is possible for a hypothesis to suddenly appear which seems to agree with one aspect of a narration, although its inventor has not taken the trouble to compare it with all the other data contained in the scriptures, and consequently not just with the Bible, plus all the data provided by history, archaeology, etc. One of the strangest hypotheses yet to come to light is by J. De Michelli, 1960, who claims to have pinpointed the date of the Exodus to within one day, that is, the 9th of April, 1495 before Christ, he relies for his information entirely on calculations made from calendars and claims that Thutmose II was reigning in Egypt at that time, and was therefore the pharaoh of the Exodus. The confirmation of the hypothesis is supposed to reside in the fact that lesions of the skin are to be observed on the mummy of Thutmose II. This commentator informs us, without explaining why, that they are due to leprosy, and that one of the plagues of Egypt described in the Bible consisted in skin boils. This staggering construction takes no account of the other facts contained in the biblical narration, especially the Bible's mention of the city of Ramesses, which rules out any hypothesis dating the Exodus before a Ramesses had reigned. As to the skin lesions of Thutmose II, these do not swing the argument in favor of the theory which designates this king of Egypt as the pharaoh of the Exodus. This is because his son, Thutmose III, and his grandson Amenophis II also show signs of skin tumors, so that some commentators have suggested the hypothesis of a disease which ran in the family. The Thutmose II theory is not therefore tenable. The same is true for Daniel Ropes's theory in his book, The People of the Bible. He ascribes the role of the pharaoh of the Exodus to Amenophis II. It does not seem to be any better founded than the preceding hypothesis. Using the pretext that Amenophis II's father, Thutmose III, was very nationalistic, Daniel Ropes proclaims Amenophis II the persecutor of the Hebrews, while his stepmother, the famous Queen Hatshepsut, is cast in the role of the person who took Moses in, although we never discover why. Father de Vaux's theory, that it was Ramesses II, rests on slightly more solid foundations. He expands on them in his book, The Ancient History of Israel. Even if his theory does not agree with the biblical narration on every point, at least it has the advantage of putting forward one very important piece of evidence: the construction of the cities of Ramesses and Pitom built under Ramesses II referred to in the biblical text. It is not possible, therefore, to maintain that the Exodus took place before the accession of Ramesses II. This is situated in the year 1301 before Christ, according to Dryerton and Vandia's chronology, and in 1290 before Christ according to Roten's. The two other hypotheses outlined above are untenable because of the following imperative fact: Ramesses II is the pharaoh of the oppression referred to in the Bible. Father de Vaux considers the Exodus to have taken place during the first half or towards the middle of Ramesses II's reign. Thus his dating of this event is imprecise. He suggests this period to allow Moses and his followers time, as it were, to settle in Canaan, and Ramesses II's successor, Pharaoh Manapter, who is said to have pacified the frontiers after his father's death, to bring the children of Israel into line, as depicted on a stele of the fifth year of his reign. Two arguments may be leveled at this theory. The Bible shows, Exodus 2:23, that the king of Egypt died during the period when Moses was in Midian. This king of Egypt is described in the book of Exodus as the king who made the Hebrews build the cities of Ramesses and Pitom by forced labor. This king was Ramesses II. The Exodus could only have taken place under the latter's successor. Father de Vaux claims, however, to doubt the biblical sources of verse 23, chapter 2 of Exodus. What is more astounding is that Father de Vaux, as director of the Biblical School of Jerusalem, does not refer in his theory of the Exodus to two essential passages in the Bible, both of which bear witness to the fact that the king died during the pursuit of the fleeing Hebrews. This detail makes it impossible for the Exodus to have taken place at any other time than at the end of a reign. It must be repeated that there can be little doubt that the pharaoh lost his life as a result of it. Chapters 13 and 14 of Exodus are quite specific on this point: so he made ready his chariot, and took his army with him. Exodus 14:6. Pharaoh king of Egypt pursued the people of Israel as they went forth defiantly, Exodus 14:8. The waters returned and covered the chariots and the horsemen, and all the host of Pharaoh that had followed them into the sea, not so much as one of them remained. Exodus 14:28 and 29. In addition to these verses, Psalm 136 confirms Pharaoh's death and refers to Yahweh who overthrew Pharaoh and his host in the Sea of Rushes, Psalms 136:15. Thus, during Moses' lifetime, one Pharaoh died when Moses was in Madian and another during the Exodus. There were not one, but two Pharaohs at the time of Moses, one during the oppression, and the other during the Exodus from Egypt. The theory of a single pharaoh, Ramesses II, put forward by Father DeVaux is unsatisfactory because it does not account for everything. The following observations are further arguments against his theory. 3. Ramesses II, Pharaoh of the Oppression Menoptah, Pharaoh of the Exodus. P. Montet has very discerningly resumed the original Alexandrian tradition mentioned by Maspero. It is found much later in the Islamic tradition as well as in the classic Christian tradition. This theory is set out in Montet's book Egypt and the Bible, and is supported by additional arguments, based in particular on the narrative contained in the Quran, to which the famous archaeologist did not refer. Before examining them, however, we shall first return to the Bible. The book of Exodus contains a reference to the word Ramesses, although the Pharaoh's name is not mentioned. In the Bible, Ramesses is the name of one of the cities built by the forced labor of the Hebrews. Today we know that these cities form part of the Tanis-Kantra region, in the eastern Nile Delta. In the area where Ramesses II built his northern capital, there were other constructions prior to his, but it was Ramesses II who made it into an important site, as the archaeological excavations undertaken in the last few decades have amply shown. To build it, he used the labor of the enslaved Hebrews. When one reads the word Ramesses in the Bible today, one is not particularly struck by it. The word has become very common to us since Champollion discovered the key to hieroglyphics 150 years ago, by examining the characters that expressed this very word. We are therefore used to reading and pronouncing it today and know what it means. One has to remember, however, that the meaning of hieroglyphics had been lost in circa the 3rd century before Christ and that Ramesses' name had hardly been preserved anywhere except in the Bible, and a few books written in Greek and Latin which had deformed it to a lesser or greater extent. It is for this reason that Tacitus in his Annals talks of Ramesses. The Bible had, however, preserved the name intact. It is referred to 4 times in the Pentateuch or Torah, Genesis 47, 11, Exodus 1, 11 and 12, 37. Numbers 33, 3 and 33, 5. The Hebrew word for Ramesses is written in 2 ways in the Bible, Ra, E-M-S-S or Rames. In the Greek version of the Bible, called the Septuagint, it is Rames. In the Latin version it is written Ramesses. In the Clementine version of the Bible in French, 1st edition, 1621, the word is the same, Ramesses. The French edition was in circulation at the time of Champollion's work in this field. In his Summary of the Hieroglyphic System of the Ancient Egyptians, 2nd edition, 1828, page 276, Champollion alludes to the biblical spelling of the word. Thus the Bible had miraculously preserved Ramesses's name in its Hebrew, Greek and Latin versions. The preceding data alone are enough to establish the following. There can be no question of the Exodus before a Ramesses had come to the throne in Egypt. 11 kings of Egypt had this name. Moses was born during the reign of the Pharaoh who built the cities of Ramesses and Pitom, that is, Ramesses II. When Moses was in Madian, the reigning Pharaoh, that is, Ramesses II, died. The continuation of Moses's story took place during the reign of Ramesses II's successor, Menoptah. What is more, the Bible adds other highly important data which help to situate the Exodus in the history of the pharaohs. It is the statement that Moses was 80 years old when, under God's orders, he tried to persuade Pharaoh to free his brothers. Now Moses was 80 years old, and Aaron 83 years old, when they spoke to Pharaoh. Exodus 7:7. Elsewhere, however, the Bible tells us, Exodus 2:23, that the Pharaoh reigning at the time of the birth of Moses died when the latter was in Madayin, although the biblical narration continues without mentioning any change in the sovereign's name. These two passages in the Bible imply that the total number of years, spanning the reigns of the two pharaohs ruling at the time when Moses was living in Egypt, must have been 80 years at least. It is known that Ramesses II reigned for 67 years, 1301-1235 before Christ according to Dryden and Vandia's chronology, 1290-1224 before Christ according to Roten. For Merneptah, his successor, the Egyptologists are unable, however, to provide the exact dates of his reign. Nevertheless, it lasted for at least 10 years because, as Father de Vaux points out, documents bear witness to the 10th year of his reign. Dryden and Vandia give two possibilities for Merneptah, either a 10-year reign, 1234-1224 before Christ, or a 20-year reign 1224-1204 before Christ. Egyptologists have no precise indications whatsoever on how Merneptah's reign came to an end. All that can be said is that after his death, Egypt went through a period of serious internal upheavals lasting nearly 25 years. Even though the chronological data on these reigns are not very precise, there was no other period during the New Kingdom concordant with the biblical narration when two successive reigns, apart from Ramesses II, Merneptah, amounted to or surpassed 80 years. The biblical data concerning Moses's age when he undertook the liberation of his brothers can only come from a time during the successive reigns of Ramesses II and Merneptah. All the evidence points towards the fact that Moses was born at the beginning of Ramesses II's reign, was living in Madayin when Ramesses II died after a 67-year reign, and subsequently became the spokesman for the cause of the Hebrews living in Egypt to Merneptah, Ramesses II's son and successor. This episode may have happened in the second half of Merneptah's reign, assuming he reigned 20 years or nearly 20 years. Roten believes the supposition to be quite feasible. Moses would then have led the Exodus at the end of Merneptah's reign. It could hardly have been otherwise because both the Bible and the Quran tell us that Pharaoh perished during the pursuit of the Hebrews leaving the country. This plan agrees perfectly with the account contained in the scriptures of Moses's infancy and of the way he was taken into the Pharaoh's family. It is a known fact that Ramesses II was very old when he died. It is said that he was 90 to 100 years old. According to this theory, he would have been 23 to 33 years old at the beginning of his reign, which lasted 67 years. He could have been married at that age, and there is nothing to contradict the discovery of Moses by a member of Pharaoh's household, according to the Quran, or the fact that Pharaoh's wife asked him if he would keep the newly born child she had found on the bank of the Nile. The Bible claims that the child was found by Pharaoh's daughter. In view of Ramesses II's age at the beginning of his reign, it would have been perfectly possible for him to have had a daughter old enough to discover the abandoned child. The Quranic and biblical narrations do not contradict each other in any way on this point. The theory given here is in absolute agreement with the Quran and is moreover at odds with only one single statement in the Bible, which occurs, as we have seen, in Kings 6:1, "This book is not included in the Torah." This passage is the subject of much debate, and Father de Vaux rejects the historical data contained in this part of the Old Testament, which dates the Exodus in relation to the construction of Solomon's temple. The fact that it is subject to doubt makes it impossible to retain it as a conclusive argument against the theory outlined here. The problem of the stele dating from the 5th year of Merneptah's reign. In the text of the famous stele dating from the 5th year of Merneptah's reign, critics think they have found an objection to the theory set out here, in which the pursuit of the Jews constituted the last act of his reign. The stele is of great interest because it represents the only known document in hieroglyphics which contains the word Israel. The inscription, which dates from the first part of Merneptah's reign, was discovered in Thebes in the Pharaoh's funeral temple. It refers to a series of victories he won over Egypt's neighboring states, in particular a victory mentioned at the end of the document over a devastated Israel which has no more seed. From this fact it has been held that the existence of the word Israel implied that the Jews must already have settled in Canaan by the fifth year of Manasseh's reign, and that in consequence, the exodus of the Hebrews from Egypt had already taken place. This objection does not seem tenable because it implies that there could have been no Jews living in Canaan all the while there were Jews in Egypt, a proposition it is impossible to accept. Father de Vaux, however, in spite of the fact that he is a supporter of the theory which makes Ramesses II the Pharaoh of the Exodus, notes the following about the settling of the Jews in Canaan, in the south. The time when communities related to the Israelites settled in the Kadesh region is unclear and dates from before the Exodus. He therefore allows for the possibility that certain groups may have left Egypt at a time different from that of Moses and his followers. The Apiru or Habiru, who have sometimes been identified with the Israelites, were already in Syria-Palestine long before Ramesses II and the Exodus. We have documentary evidence which proves that Amenophis II brought back 8,600 prisoners to work as forced laborers in Egypt. Others were to be found in Canaan under Sethus I, where they caused unrest in the Beth-Shean region. P. Montet reminds us of this in his book Egypt and the Bible. It is quite plausible to suppose, therefore, that Manasseh was obliged to deal severely with these rebellious elements on his borders, while inside them were those who were later to rally around Moses to flee the country. The existence of the stele dating from the fifth year of Manasseh's reign does not in any way detract from the present theory. Moreover, the fact that the word Israel figures in the history of the Jewish people is totally unconnected with the notion that Moses and his followers settled in Canaan. The origin of the word is as follows. According to Genesis 32, 29, Israel is the second name given to Jacob, son of Isaac and grandson of Abraham. The commentators of the Ecumenical Translation of the Bible Old Testament, 1975, think that its meaning is probably that God shows himself in his strength. Since it has been given to a single man, it is not surprising that it was given to a community or group of people in memory of a distinguished ancestor. The name Israel, therefore, appeared well before Moses, several hundred years before to be exact. It is not surprising, consequently, to see it cited in a stele from the reign of the pharaoh Manasseh. The fact that it is cited does not at all constitute an argument in favor of a theory which dates the Exodus before the fifth year of Manasseh's reign. What it does do is refer to a group which it calls Israel, but Manasseh's stele cannot be alluding to a politically established collectivity because the inscription dates from the end of the 13th century before Christ and the Kingdom of Israel was not formed until the 10th century before Christ. It must therefore refer to a human community of more modest proportions. Nowadays, we know that the entry of Israel into history was preceded by a long formatory period of 8 or 9 centuries. This period was distinguished by the settling of many semi-nomadic groups, especially the Amorites and the Eremaeans all over the region. In the same period, patriarchs began to appear in their communities, among whom were Abraham, Isaac and Jacob Israel. The second name of this last patriarch was used to designate the original group, the nucleus of a future political entity which was to appear long after Manasseh's reign, since the Kingdom of Israel lasted from 931 or 930 to 721 before Christ. 4. The description contained in the Holy Scriptures of the Pharaoh's death during the Exodus. This event marks a very important point in the narrations contained in the Bible and the Quran. It stands forth very clearly in the texts. It is referred to in the Bible, not only in the Pentateuch or Torah, but also in the Psalms. The references have already been given. It is very strange to find that Christian commentators have completely ignored it. Thus, Father de Vaux maintains the theory that the Exodus from Egypt took place in the first half or the middle of Ramesses II's reign. His theory takes no account of the fact that the Pharaoh perished during the Exodus, a fact which should make all hypotheses place the event at the end of a reign. In his Ancient History of Israel, the head of the Biblical School of Jerusalem does not seem to be at all troubled by the contradiction between the theory he maintains and the data contained in the two books of the Bible, the Torah and Psalms. In his book, Egypt and the Bible, Piemontek places the Exodus during Menapta's reign, but says nothing about the death of the Pharaoh, who was at the head of the army following the fleeing Hebrews. This highly surprising attitude contrasts with the Jews' outlook. Psalm 136, verse 15 gives thanks to God who overthrew Pharaoh and his host in the Sea of Rushes and is often recited in their liturgy. They know of the agreement between this verse and the passage in Exodus 14, 28-29, the waters returned and covered the chariots and the horsemen, and all the host of Pharaoh that had followed them into the sea, not so much as one of them remained. There is no shadow of a doubt for them that the Pharaoh and his troops were wiped out. These same texts are present in Christian Bibles. Christian commentators quite deliberately, and in contradiction to all the evidence, brush aside the Pharaoh's death. What is more, however, some of them mention the reference made to it in the Quran and encourage their readers to make very strange comparisons. In the translation of the Bible directed by the Biblical School of Jerusalem, we find the following commentary on the Pharaoh's death by Father Courier. The Quran refers to this, Pharaoh's death, Surah 10, verses 90-92, and popular tradition has it that the Pharaoh who was drowned with his army, an event which is not mentioned in the holy text, lives beneath the ocean where he rules over the men of the sea, i.e. the seals. It is obvious that the uninformed reader of the Quran is bound to establish a connection between a statement in it which, for the commentator, contradicts the biblical text and this absurd legend which comes from a so-called popular tradition mentioned in the commentary after the reference to the Quran. The real meaning of the statement in the Quran on this has nothing to do with what this commentator suggests, verses 90-92, Surah 10 inform us that the children of Israel crossed the sea while the Pharaoh and his troops were pursuing them and that it was only when the Pharaoh was about to be drowned that he cried, I believe there is no God except the God in which the children of Israel believe. I am of those who submit themselves to him. God replied, What? Now? Thou hast rebelled and caused depravity. This day we save thee in thy body so that thou mayest be a sign for those who will come after thee. This is all that the Surah contains on the Pharaoh's death. There is no question of the phantasms recorded by the biblical commentator either here or anywhere else in the Quran. The text of the Quran merely states very clearly that the Pharaoh's body will be saved, that is the important piece of information. When the Quran was transmitted to man by the Prophet, the bodies of all the Pharaohs who are today considered, rightly or wrongly, to have something to do with the Exodus were in their tombs of the necropolis of Thebes, on the opposite side of the Nile from Luxor. At the time, however, absolutely nothing was known of this fact, and it was not until the end of the 19th century that they were discovered there. As the Quran states, the body of the Pharaoh of the Exodus was in fact rescued, whichever of the pharaohs it was, visitors may see him in the Royal Mummies Room of the Egyptian Museum, Cairo. The truth is therefore very different from the ludicrous legend that Father Courier has attached to the Quran. 5. Pharaoh Menapta's mummy. The mummified body of Menapta, son of Ramesses II and Pharaoh of the Exodus, all the evidence points to this, was discovered by Lorit in 1898 at Thebes in the King's Valley, whence it was transported to Cairo. Elliot Smith removed its wrappings on the 8th of July, 1907. He gives a detailed description of this operation and the examination of the body in his book The Royal Mummies, 1912. At that time the mummy was in a satisfactory state of preservation, in spite of deterioration in several parts. Since then, the mummy has been on show to visitors at the Cairo Museum, with his head and neck uncovered and the rest of body concealed under a cloth. It is so well hidden indeed, that until very recently, the only general photographs of the mummy that the museum possessed were those taken by E. Smith in 1912. In June 1975, the Egyptian high authorities very kindly allowed me to examine the parts of the pharaoh's body that had been covered until then. They also allowed me to take photographs. When the mummy's present state was compared to the condition it was in over 60 years ago, it was abundantly clear that it had deteriorated and fragments had disappeared. The mummified tissues had suffered greatly, at the hand of man in some places and through the passage of time in others. This natural deterioration is easily explained by the changes in the conditions of conservation from the time in the late 19th century when it was discovered. Its discovery took place in the tomb of the necropolis of Thebes, where the mummy had lain for over 3,000 years. Today, the mummy is displayed in a simple glass case which does not afford hermetic insulation from the outside, nor does it offer protection from pollution by microorganisms. The mummy is exposed to fluctuations in temperature and seasonal changes in humidity. It is very far from the conditions which enabled it to remain protected from any source of deterioration for approximately 3,000 years. It has lost the protection afforded by its wrappings and the advantage of remaining in the closed environment of the tomb, where the temperature was more constant and the air less humid than it is in Cairo at certain times of the year. Of course, while it was in the necropolis itself, the mummy had to withstand the visits of grave plunderers, probably very early on, and rodents. They caused a certain amount of damage, but the conditions were nevertheless, it seems, much more favorable for it to stand the test of time than they are today. At my suggestion, special investigations were made during this examination of the mummy in June 1975. An excellent radiographic study was made by Drs. El-Meleji and Ramses, and the examination of the interior of the thorax, through a gap in the thoracic wall, was carried out by Dr. Mustafa Manayalawi in addition to an investigation of the abdomen. This was the first example of endoscopy being applied to a mummy. This technique enabled us to see and photograph some very important details inside the body. Professor Sekaldi performed a general medico-legal study which will be completed by an examination under the microscope of some small fragments that spontaneously fell from the mummy's body. This examination will be carried out by Professor Mignot and Dr. Durigone. I regret to say that definitive pronouncements cannot be made by the time this book goes to print. What may already be derived from this examination is the discovery of multiple lesions of the bones with broad lacunae, some of which may have been mortal, although it is not yet possible to ascertain whether some of them occurred before or after the pharaoh's death. He most probably died either from drowning, according to the scriptural narrations, or from very violent shocks preceding the moment when he was drowned, or both at once. The connection of these lesions with the deterioration whose sources have been mentioned above renders the correct preservation of the mummy of the pharaoh somewhat problematical, unless precautionary and restorative measures are not taken very soon. These measures should ensure that the only concrete evidence which we still possess today concerning the death of the pharaoh of the Exodus and the rescue of his body, willed by God, does not disappear with the passage of time. It is always desirable for man to apply himself to the preservation of relics of his history, but here we have something which goes beyond that. It is the material presence of the mummified body of the man who knew Moses, resisted his pleas, pursued him as he took flight, lost his life in the process. His earthly remains were saved by the will of God from destruction to become a sign to man, as it is written in the Quran. Those who seek among modern data for proof of the veracity of the Holy Scriptures will find a magnificent illustration of the verses of the Quran dealing with the Pharaoh's body by visiting the Royal Mummies Room of the Egyptian Museum, Cairo. Translator's note: the results of these medical studies carried out in Cairo, 1976, were read by the author before several French learned societies, including the Académie Nationale de Médecine, National Academy of Medicine, during the first part of 1976. The knowledge of these results led the Egyptian authorities to take the decision to transport the mummy of Ramesses II to France. Thus it arrived for treatment in Paris on the 26th of September 1976. The Quran, a hadith and modern science. The Quran does not constitute the sole source of doctrine and legislation in Islam. During Muhammad's life and after his death, complementary information of a legislative nature was indeed sought in the study of the words and deeds of the Prophet. Although writing was used in the transmission of hadith from the very beginning, a lot of this came also from the oral tradition. Those who undertook to assemble them in collections made the kind of inquiries which are always very taxing before recording accounts of past events. They nevertheless had a great regard for accuracy in their arduous task of collecting information. This is illustrated by the fact that for all of the prophets' sayings, the most venerable collections always bear the names of those responsible for the account, going right back to the person who first collected the information from members of Muhammad's family or his companions. A very large number of collections of the Prophet's words and deeds thus appeared under the title of a hadith. The exact meaning of the word is utterances, but it is also customary to use it to mean the narration of his deeds. Some of the collections were made public in the decades following Muhammad's death. Just over 200 years were to pass before some of the most important collections appeared. The most authentic record of the facts is in the collections of Al-Bukhari and Muslim, which date from over 200 years after Muhammad and which provide a wider trustworthy account. In recent years, a bilingual Arabic and English edition has been provided by Dr. Muhammad Mohsen Khan, of the Islamic University of Medina. Al-Bukhari's work is generally regarded as the most authentic after the Quran, and was translated into French, 1903-1914, by Hudas and Marquet under the title Lay Traditions Islamiques, Islamic Traditions. The ahadith are therefore accessible to those who do not speak Arabic. One must, however, be wary of certain translations made by Europeans, including the French translation, because they contain inaccuracies and untruths which are often more of interpretation than of actual translation. Sometimes, they considerably change the real meaning of a hadith, to such an extent indeed that they attribute a sense to it which it does not contain. As regards their origins, some of the ahadith and gospels have one point in common, which is that neither of them was compiled by an author who was an eyewitness of the events he describes. Nor were they compiled until some time after the events recorded. The ahadith, like the gospels, have not all been accepted as authentic. Only a small number of them receive the quasi-unanimous approval of specialists in Muslim tradition, so that, except Al-Muwatta, Sahih Muslim and Sahih al-Bukhari, one finds in the same book, a hadith presumed to be authentic side by side with ones which are either dubious, or should be rejected outright. In contrast to canonic gospels, which though questioned by some modern scholars but which have never been contested by Christian high authorities, even those ahadith that are most worthy to be considered as authentic have been the subject of criticism. Very early in the history of Islam, masters in Islamic thought exercised a thorough criticism of the ahadith, although the basic book, the Quran, remained the book of reference, and was not to be questioned. I thought it of interest to delve into the literature of the ahadith to find out how Muhammad is said to have expressed himself, outside the context of written revelation, on subjects that were to be explained by scientific progress in following centuries. Although Sahih Muslim is also an authentic collection, in this study I have strictly limited myself to the texts of the ahadith which are generally considered to be the most authentic, that is, those of Al-Bukhari. I have always tried to bear in mind the fact that these texts were compiled by men according to data received from a tradition which was partially oral, and that they record certain facts with a greater or lesser degree of accuracy, depending on the individual errors made by those who transmitted the narrations. These texts are different from other ahadith which were transmitted by very large number of people and are unquestionably authentic. I have compared the findings made during an examination of the ahadith with those already set out in the section on the Quran and modern science. The results of this comparison speak for themselves. The difference is in fact quite staggering between the accuracy of the data contained in the Quran, when compared with modern scientific knowledge, and the highly questionable character of certain statements in the ahadith on subjects whose tenor is essentially scientific. These are the only ahadith to have been dealt with in this study. Ahadith which have as their subject the interpretation of certain verses of the Quran sometimes lead to commentaries which are hardly acceptable today. We have already seen the great significance of one verse, Surah 36, verse 36, dealing with the sun which runs its course to a settled place. Here is the interpretation given of it in a hadith: at sunset, the sun prostrates itself underneath the throne, and takes permission to rise again, and it is permitted, and then, a time will come when, it will be about to prostrate itself, it will ask permission to go on its course, it will be ordered to return whence it has come, and so it will rise in the west. Sahih al-Bukhari. The original text, the Book of the Beginning of the Creation, Volume 4, page 283, Part 54, Chapter 4, Number 421, is obscure and difficult to translate. This passage nevertheless contains an allegory which implies the notion of a course the sun runs in relation to the earth. Science has shown the contrary to be the case. The authenticity of this hadith is doubtful, Zani. Another passage from the same work, the Book of the Beginning of the Creation, Volume 4, page 283, Part 54, Chapter 6, Number 430, estimates the initial stages in the development of the embryo very strangely in time, a 40-day period for the grouping of the elements which are to constitute the human being, another 40 days during which the embryo is represented as something which clings, and a third 40-day period, when the embryo is designated by the term chewed flesh. Once the angels have intervened to define what this individual's future is to be, a soul is breathed into him. This description of embryonic evolution does not agree with modern data. Whereas the Quran gives absolutely no practical advice on the remedial arts, except for a single comment, Surah 16, verse 69, on the possibility of using honey as a therapeutic aid, without indicating the illness involved, the Ahadith devote a great deal of space to these subjects. A whole section of al-Bukhari's collection, part 76, is concerned with medicine. In the French translation by Houdas and Marquet it goes from page 62 to 91 of volume 4, and in Dr. Mohamed Mohsen Khan's bilingual Arabic and English edition from page 395 to 452, of volume 7. There can be no doubt that these pages contain some ahadith which are conjectural, Zani, but they are interesting as a whole because they provide an outline of the opinions on various medical subjects that it was possible to hold at the time. One might add to them several ahadith inserted in other parts of al-Bukhari's collection which have a medical tenor. This is how we come to find statements in them on the harms caused by the evil eye, witchcraft and the possibility of exorcism, although a certain restriction is imposed on the paid use of the Quran for this purpose. There is a hadith which stresses that certain kinds of date may serve as protection against the effects of magic, and magic may be used against poisonous snake bites. We should not be surprised, however, to find that at a time when there were limited possibilities for the scientific use of drugs, people were advised to rely on simple practices, natural treatments such as bloodletting, cupping, and cauterization, head shaving against lice, the use of camel's milk and certain seeds such as black cumin, and plants such as Indian kust. It was also recommended to burn a mat made of palm tree leaves and put the ash from it into a wound to stop bleeding. In emergencies, all available means that might genuinely be of use had to be employed. It does not seem a priori to be a very good idea, however, to suggest that people drink camel's urine. It is difficult today to subscribe to certain explanations of subjects related to various illnesses. Among them, the following might be mentioned. The origins of a fever. There are four statements bearing witness to the fact that fever is from the heat of hell. Al-Bukhari, The Book of Medicine, Volume 7, Chapter 28, page 416. The existence of a remedy for every illness. No disease God created, but He created its treatment. Ibid. Chapter 1, page 396. This concept is illustrated by the hadith of the fly. If a fly falls into the vessel of any of you, let him dip all of it into the vessel, and then throw it away, for in one of its wings there is a disease and in the other there is healing, antidote for it. That is, the treatment for that disease. Ibid. Chapter 15 to 16, pages 462 to 463. Also, the Book of the Beginning of Creation, Part 54, chapters 15 and 16. Abortion provoked by the sight of a snake, which can also blind. This is mentioned in the Book of the Beginning of Creation, Volume 4, Chapter 13 and 14, pages 330 and 334. Hemorrhages between periods. The Book of Menses, Menstrual Periods, Volume 6, Part 6, pages 490 and 495 contains two ahadith on the cause of hemorrhages between periods, chapters 21 and 28. They refer to two women. In the case of the first, there is a description, undetailed, of the symptoms, with a statement that the hemorrhage comes from a blood vessel. In the second, the woman had experienced hemorrhages between periods for 7 years, and the same vascular origin is stated. One might suggest hypotheses as to the real causes of the above, but it is not easy to see what arguments could have been produced at the time to support this diagnosis. This could nevertheless have been quite accurate. The statement that diseases are not contagious. Al-Bukhari's collection of ahadith refers in several places, chapters 19, 25, 30, 31, 53 and 54, volume 7, part 76, of the Book of Medicine, to certain special cases, for example leprosy, page 408, plague, pages 418 and 422, camel's scabies, page 447, and also provides general statements. The latter are, however, placed side by side with glaringly contradictory remarks. It is recommended, for example, not to go to areas where there is plague, and to stay away from lepers. Consequently, it is possible to conclude that certain ahadith exist which are scientifically unacceptable. There is a doubt surrounding their authenticity. The purpose of reference to them lies solely in the comparison that they occasion with the verses of the Quran mentioned above. These do not contain a single inaccurate statement. This observation clearly has considerable importance. One must indeed remember that at the Prophet's death, the teachings that were received from this fell into two groups. Firstly, a large number of believers knew the Quran by heart because, like the Prophet, they had recited it many, many times. Transcriptions of the text of the Quran already existed, moreover, which were made at the time of the Prophet and even before the Hijrah. Secondly, the members of his following who were closest to him and the believers who had witnessed his words and deeds had remembered them and relied on them for support, in addition to the Quran, when defining a nascent doctrine and legislation. In the years that were to follow the Prophet's death, texts were to be compiled which recorded the two groups of teachings he had left. The first gathering of ahadith was performed roughly 40 years after the Hijrah, but a first collection of Quranic texts had been made beforehand under Caliph Abu Bakr, and in particular Caliph Uthman, the second of whom published a definitive text during his caliphate, that is, between the 12th and 24th years following Muhammad's death. What must be heavily stressed is the disparity between these two groups of texts, both from a literary point of view and as regards their contents. It would indeed be unthinkable to compare the style of the Quran with that of the ahadith. What is more, when the contents of the two texts are compared in the light of modern scientific data, one is struck by the oppositions between them. I hope I have succeeded in showing what follows. On the one hand, statements in the Quran which often appear to be commonplace, but which conceal data that science was later to bring to light. On the other hand, certain statements in the ahadith which are shown to be in absolute agreement with the ideas of their times but which contain opinions that are deemed scientifically unacceptable today. These occur in an aggregate of statements concerning Islamic doctrine and legislation, whose authenticity is unquestioningly acknowledged. Finally, it must be pointed out that Muhammad's own attitude was quite different towards the Quran from what it was towards his personal sayings. The Quran was proclaimed by him to be a divine revelation. Over a period of 20 years, the Prophet classified its sections with the greatest of care, as we have seen. The Quran represented what had to be written down during his own lifetime and learned by heart to become part of the liturgy of prayers. The ahadith are said, in principle, to provide an account of his deeds and personal reflections, but he left it to others to find an example in them for their own behavior and to make them public however they liked. He did not give any instructions. In view of the fact that only a limited number of ahadith may be considered to express the Prophet's thoughts with certainty, the others must contain the thoughts of the men of his time, in particular with regard to the subjects referred to here. When these dubious or inauthentic ahadith are compared to the text of the Quran, we can measure the extent to which they differ. This comparison highlights, as if there were still any need to, the striking difference between the writings of this period, which are riddled with scientific inaccurate statements, and the Quran, the book of written revelation, that is free from errors of this kind. General conclusions. At the end of this study, a fact that stands forth very clearly is that the predominant opinion held in the West on the texts of the Holy Scriptures we possess today is hardly very realistic. We have seen the conditions, times and ways in which the elements constituting the Old Testament, the Gospels and the Quran were collected and written down, the circumstances attendant upon the birth of the Scriptures for these three revelations differed widely in each case, a fact which had extremely important consequences concerning the authenticity of the texts and certain aspects of their contents. The Old Testament represents a vast number of literary works written over a period of roughly 900 years. It forms a highly disparate mosaic whose pieces have, in the course of centuries, been changed by man. Some parts were added to what already existed, so that today it is sometimes very difficult indeed to identify where they came from originally. Through an account of Jesus's words and deeds, the Gospels were intended to make known to men the teachings he wished to leave them on completion of his earthly mission. Unfortunately, the authors of the Gospels were not eyewitnesses of the data they recorded. They were spokesmen who expressed data that were quite simply the information that had been preserved by the various Judeo-Christian communities on Jesus's public life, passed down by oral traditions or writings which no longer exist today, and which constituted an intermediate stage between the oral tradition and the definitive texts. This is the light in which the Judeo-Christian scriptures should be viewed today, and to be objective, one should abandon the classic concepts held by experts in exegesis. The inevitable result of the multiplicity of sources is the existence of contradictions and oppositions. Many examples have been given of these. The authors of the Gospels had, when talking of Jesus, the same tendency to magnify certain facts as the poets of French medieval literature in their narrative poems. The consequence of this was that events were presented from each individual narrator's point of view, and the authenticity of the facts reported in many cases proved to be extremely dubious. In view of this, the few statements contained in the Judeo-Christian scriptures which may have something to do with modern knowledge should always be examined with the circumspection that the questionable nature of their authenticity demands. Contradictions, improbabilities and incompatibilities with modern scientific data may be easily explained in terms of what has just been said above. Christians are nevertheless very surprised when they realize this. So great have been the continuous and far-reaching efforts made until now by many official commentators to camouflage the very obvious results of modern studies, under cunning dialectical acrobatics orchestrated by apologetic lyricism. A case in point are the genealogies of Jesus given in Matthew and Luke, which were contradictory and scientifically unacceptable. Examples have been provided which reveal this attitude very clearly. John's Gospel has been given special attention because there are very important differences between it and the other three Gospels, especially with regard to the fact that his Gospel does not describe the institution of the Eucharist. This is not generally known. The Quranic revelation has a history which is fundamentally different from the other two. It spanned a period of some 20 years and, as soon as it was transmitted to Muhammad by Archangel Gabriel, believers learned it by heart. It was also written down during Muhammad's life. The last recensions of the Quran were effected under Caliph Uthman starting some 12 years after the Prophet's death and finishing 24 years after it. They had the advantage of being checked by people who already knew the text by heart, for they had learned it at the time of the revelation itself, and had subsequently recited it constantly. Since then, we know that the text has been scrupulously preserved. It does not give rise to any problems of authenticity. The Quran follows on from the two revelations that preceded it and is not only free from contradictions in its narrations, the sign of the various human manipulations to be found in the Gospels, but provides a quality all of its own for those who examine it objectively and in the light of science, that is, its complete agreement with modern scientific data. What is more, statements are to be found in it, as has been shown, that are connected with science, And yet it is unthinkable that a man of Muhammad's time could have been the author of them. Modern scientific knowledge therefore allows us to understand certain verses of the Quran which, until now, it has been impossible to interpret. The comparison of several biblical and Quranic narrations of the same subject shows the existence of fundamental differences between statements in the former, which are scientifically unacceptable, and declarations in the latter which are in perfect agreement with modern data. This was the case of the creation and the flood, for example. An extremely important complement to the Bible was found in the text of the Quran on the subject of the history of the Exodus, where the two texts were very much in agreement with archaeological findings, in the dating of the time of Moses. Besides, there are major differences between the Quran and the Bible on the other subjects. They serve to disprove all that has been maintained, without a scrap of evidence, concerning the allegation that Muhammad is supposed to have copied the Bible to produce the text of the Quran. When a comparative study is made between the statements connected with science to be found in the collection of a hadith, which are attributed to Muhammad but are often of dubious authenticity, although they reflect the beliefs of the period, and the data of a similar kind in the Quran, the disparity becomes so obvious that any notion of a common origin is ruled out. In view of the level of knowledge in Muhammad's day, it is inconceivable that many of the statements in the Quran which are connected with science could have been the work of a man. It is, moreover, perfectly legitimate, not only to regard the Quran as the expression of a revelation, but also to award it a very special place, on account of the guarantee of authenticity it provides and the presence in it of scientific statements which, when studied today, appear as a challenge to explanation in human terms.